Hello and welcome to Our Dad's Died with me, Tom.
And me, Rich. And welcome to one of the first episodes that wasn't recorded 100,000 years ago. This episode was recorded a couple of weeks ago. We caught up with Michelle Brazier. Tom, do you want to explain Michelle Brazier to our lovely listeners?
She's an Australian comedian. You've probably seen her tour around. If you go to Edinburgh often, you might have seen her there. If you watch a lot of YouTube and you're familiar with Auntie Donna, then you've seen her pop up on there as well as on their Netflix show. And she's based in Edinburgh too, throughout the month of August. So if you are there, do see her. But we'll talk about that more at the end.
Before that, let's get into it. Let's start this episode. And this episode actually starts with Michelle scolding us for our very British drinking habits. Correct. So here we go. This is our...
That's...
They died!
They died.
Both dead. Both dead.
That's the crux of the old show.
Miss you, Daddy.
Beverage in the morning.
Know.
Is it your
so
morning?
Sorry.
What's that?
It's midday.
What are you doing?
It's drinking time. But it's sort of tradition. Well, how this whole podcast started was that we used to go to the pub and talk about our dads.
Yep.
And so we thought when we do the podcast, it's sort of tradition that we have a beer while we do
okay,
it.
Okay, that's great. Well, I've had a whiskey. I've had people over for dinner. They've left. It's so late. So I've had a drink.
Right. I've still got the taste of toothpaste in my mouth.
Yeah, you've got a lovely mix.
Very different. Yeah, it's quite a minty beer that I'm going for, but
yeah, I'm sort of on four different drinks at the moment, so it's really what's going to pop up next at this point. But yes, anyway,
that's great. It's an exciting time.
It is mid morning, four different alcoholic beverages.
No,
on the go.
To clarify, just one. Thank you. The thing about this podcast is that we do kind of laugh a lot, even when sometimes the topic does. It's not a topic where you would normally laugh. That's the point of the podcast, really, is that me and Rich used to meet up in a pub and talk about things and then start laughing when you shouldn't laugh at that thing. So I like to preface before we talk to guests to sort of say, just so you know, if you say something miserably sad and I start laughing, that's simply because I never learned how to deal with emotions.
It's fine. I've met men.
Yeah.
It's fine. Yeah, but also, like, you know, I've basically built a career on funny, sad.
Yep. Yeah.
Yes.
And I mean, there's quite a lot of source material there from what I understand.
Yes, an absurd amount.
Yeah.
I think we're all
roughly the same age, or at least in the same kind of ballpark. We all kind of graduated in that kind of 2010-ish kind of area. So I feel like our generation is the one which kind of we graduated and then the world kind of went, yes, but the economy is ruined. Good luck getting a job. Ha 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 ha. However, like, welcome to adulthood. However, my understanding is that your welcome to adulthood was like you had that, but also a little bit shit too. Also a little bit more shit.
Yes, my welcome to adulthood was like, guess what, bitch? Everything's going wrong. Because I had like such a lovely adolescence. Like I loved being a teenager. I went to school happy. If I was sick, I was like, I'm still going to go because I want to hang out with my friends. I really loved school and I loved my life. And we weren't rich, but I didn't know that. I thought that we were like this rich family because I went to a very poor school and I was probably one of the richest kids there. Right. Like I had no perspective. I had no understanding of like what the world was. I didn't know like until I moved to Melbourne because I grew up in Wagga Wagga, which is the teen pregnancy capital of Australia.
Sure. Oh, congratulations.
Thank you so much. We did it. I didn't know that you could have a pool. Like I didn't. That's crazy. Like I didn't even know you could have your own pool. That's madness. Until I moved to Melbourne and I got into this really fancy art school that I thought that it would take me years and years to get into, but it didn't. And I got in when I was very young and I went there and everyone was very rich and I was very confused and very fish out of water. But I was still, you know, really happy and grateful. And then just life hit me in the face. I don't know. Should I go into it? Should I go into it right now?
Let's get stuck in. Yeah. So we've got the premise has been set up. Michelle had a lovely childhood. What could possibly go wrong?
I had a lovely childhood, yes. And I was in first year acting school at this fancy acting school. And I'm a very strong singer, and that, I think that's why I got in so young. And I remember them saying to me at the end of first year, they were like, you've just got no life experience. Like, you've got no, like, sadness to draw on. You've got, you're just kind of just happy to be here. And I was like, yep. I don't know what you want me to do about that. And they're like, just take a year off and go live. And I was like, okay. So I took a year off and I booked a trip to Europe. I was actually meant to fly into Glasgow because I was obsessed with Scotland. Like, I think I was a bit, I wasn't very cool in terms of, I was very horny for Doctor Who. So I wanted to, like, I think I thought if I went to Glasgow, then I would somehow have sex with David Tennant in some way. I think that was like the plan. And I was also really interested in the Royal Scottish Academy of Music and Drama. So I was like, I want to go over there. I want to, like, audition for that school, and I want to, like, see Scotland, and I'm very interested in it. Anyway, and then a month before I was meant to go, I was standing next to a heater, which I'm sure you're familiar with being in the UK. Standing next to a heater, and it was one of those bar heaters. Do you know the ones that are, like, red? They kind of glow red.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, it's a big fucking literal warning sign that you shouldn't go near it, but I was very close to it and I caught on fire and I had to learn to walk again.
You can't just anyway, like, let's just skip over this bit. What are you talking about?
And when you say you caught on fire, how, like the flame?
Yeah, you know, a candle, but like me. So
yeah, bigger than a candle, obviously. I'm assuming bigger than a candle.
But yeah, I caught on fire and I was like running up and down the hallway trying to not be on fire. One of my housemates, risked her life, like, you know, burnt herself, throwing me into the shower, turning on the water.
Wow.
I went to the hospital. I got skin grafts. I had to learn to walk again. And I was 18 years old. So I had to learn to walk again.
Jesus
and
Christ.
You know, I was like, what? Yeah, it was quite mad. And when I got out of the hospital, I had to have hospital at home care for about a year, where someone would come and shower me, which is, humiliating. But yeah, I got out and I found out, like, I was like, where's dad? Like, my parents are still together. I was like, where's dad? And mum was like, dad's not well. And then, we got a call that he'd been diagnosed with cancer, which was a real surprise. It was a real shock.
Mm.
And it was pancreatic cancer, stage 4, which is often when pancreatic cancer will get diagnosed, is like quite late in the game. And he died like 7 days later. He just died.
Oh my God.
Right away. Yeah. So
it was that fast. Just found out a week later.
It was really fast. Yeah.
Wow.
And I went home. Like, I got to see him. My best friend James, who is just a wonderful, wonderful figure in my life. And he had taken all of this leave from, he was like the only person I knew in my life who had a full-time job, because he had really, like, young parents. The reason we were friends, my parents were old, his were young, and my older sister was the same age as his mother. As I said, teenage pregnancy capital of Australia. She was 16 when she had him. And so he had ended up sort of raising her. Like, he had done all of this work to support her, support his siblings. And then so immediately, as soon as we're 18, like as soon as we were 15, he had a full-time job. He left school. And when I moved to Melbourne to go to art school, he was like, all right, I'm coming. And he just came and just moved in with me and looked after me and had a full-time job. And so he used up all his leave looking after me in the hospital, watching Tyra Banks on America's Next Top Model. And then he, in the middle of the night, I woke up one night, because dad had been diagnosed, and there was a few days, 2 days later, I was like, I think I should go. Because they said to us, we think we'll have another Christmas. And this was in the middle of the year.
Oh, right.
They were like, he should have at least until Christmas. And I was like, okay. But then 2 days later, I was like, nah, something's wrong. And I woke up James in the middle of the night and he said, I don't have any leave left. And I said, that's okay. I've got to go. Can I borrow your car? And he said, I'll quit my job. And he and I drove through the middle of the night, and we got in Australia, like, you drive a lot, and it's normal. But like, I live a 6-hour drive from my parents, and we got halfway there, and my brother called me in the middle of the night and said, hey, we're gonna book you on the next flight in the morning because dad's not well. And I was like, I'm in Albury, which is 2 hours away. I was like, I'm already there. I just had a feeling something was wrong, and I spent the next day with him, said goodbye to him, and we were all kind of there when he went, which was really good. But yeah, it was fast. It was really, really fast.
And what was that? I mean, it's a huge amount of information to sort of, a huge adjustment within 1 week. How was that one day that you had with him? What was the experience of that like?
It was a strange one.
Was he in a hospital at the time, or was he at home?
He was in hospital, so I never got to see him again in context. You know, he was this kind of sickly looking, pale, that version of the dying person that you're like, that's the bit you don't really want to remember. But he was that guy already. Like, he had, it was actually really funny. This is very dark, but I think appropriate for you guys. But he was an overweight man, like quite obese, I guess. If we want to use that language, but like, he was a really big guy and he had type 2 diabetes and he was supposed to be on a diet. And we for ages were like, he's sneaking food. Like, there's no way. But he wasn't sneaking food. He just had a fucking huge tumor in his stomach.
Oh my God.
And we had been the whole time, we'd be like, fucking, you fucking liar. You're fucking lying, you little rat. And actually, he'd like been trying his best, but it was just this huge tumor. So that was quite like sad and funny.
Oh my God. My dad had the reverse of that, which is, of course, he was also an obese man. The tumours were sort of in other more hidden places. But before he was diagnosed, he was getting slimmer and slimmer and slimmer without trying. So he just sort of, I don't know, he just sort of thought that like his metabolism had like, I don't know, just become that of a 20-year-old. He was like, I can eat whatever I like.
That's amazing. That's so funny. Yeah, it's really just like the enormous red flags that your body will put up and you're like, I think actually this is a sign of my virtue.
But I don't need to see a doctor for this, right? No, this is fine. This is me being the best.
This is fine. This is normal. But yeah, so he was like, but my dog used to like sit on his stomach all the time. And the day that he died was really beautiful because the hospital let us bring the dog in.
Oh, nice.
Which apparently is really rare. And she was like quite a mad dog. She would run around. It's just a little dog. You know how little dogs are kind of cats and they kind of just run around and bark a lot. She's like that. But she was very calm and very stoic and just sat on his lap. And she was really beautiful. But the day he, I remember he had this estranged brother. He was so annoying and he made a big show of it. Like, he came back into his life and was like, I'm back. And it was like, who are you? Like, it was just annoying. You're annoying. You're another thing for us to deal with.
Your life's starting to sound a little bit telenovela at this point.
Yeah, well, listen, we are a Spanish family, so it makes
sense.
There
it is, yeah.
Yeah, we got Spanish there, so we had to make it dramatic. And obviously, in keeping with the telenovela, I started a relationship with a new man on the day my father died. Somebody call a psychologist.
Oh, yes.
Somebody call a psychologist. But yeah, we got together.
I did the exact same thing.
Did you? Did it last?
I started a relationship 2 days after my dad's funeral.
Wow.
And we got one pretty miserable year together.
Wow.
Which was, that's something.
I had 7 miserable years. Hold on.
Oh, wow.
7 years from that relationship.
Yes.
Oh, well played.
No,
terrible decision.
It wasn't great. I mean, it was fine.
Had he met your dad, or
he met him as he was
so
dying?
That was the,
and so it was like
the thing. It's like,
I think that's why
once
I held
that
on.
Relationship ends.
Yeah, and he came to the funeral. Yeah. Yes, it was like, all right. And the day we got together was the day Dad died. It was like, all right, this is official. And he was very depressed. And it was like, all right, well, obviously, it was like, oh, this is something I can fix.
Here's someone
I can save.
You were like,
this will work. This will be
he's
fine.
He's depressed. And you were like, I've got the mental capacity to help him. That's, I'm in a place where I can get him better. That's what I need to focus on, is someone else's mental health right now.
Yes, that's what I did. That is exactly what I did. Which was, you know, beautiful and a dream. And everyone was like, okay, I guess she loves this guy. His name was Wayne as well, which is unfortunate for him. But my brother was a very big advocate against me being with him. And then my brother also died. So, I mean, was it Wayne? I don't know. Who knows? You know?
Was this while you were still with Wayne?
Yes. Which is another reason
I was going to say, so Wayne's really deep in the family connection at this point.
He had like seen a lot of it. When my brother died, it was from a similar cancer to my dad. So it turns out to be this genetic thing that we might all have. And if you want to learn more about it in a more dramatic way, please watch Average Bear on Paramount Plus. but it's like, when he passed away, that was like, oh, okay, something's up. But I was actually in Edinburgh when my brother died. And I had the most amazing night. So I had this show. I was doing this show called Space Tortoise, which is a show I wrote after we'd lost Dad. Mm-hmm. And it was about a tortoise who wants to go to space to show her dad how tall she's gotten. Her dad is like the first tortoise to go into space, to be sent into space by Russia. Sure. Listen, we all, you know, we grieve differently.
Yeah.
I wrote a show about a tortoise. So I was doing that, which was my first ever solo show in Edinburgh at 11:45 p.m. in a 40-seater nice. Venue, because I'm a businesswoman. I had this bit in the show where I would come out and I'd be like, did you guys bring your snow globes? And everyone would say no, obviously, because you sure. wouldn't. It was just a funny little bit. And then when no one would have a snow globe, I would say, okay, I'll go first. And I would tell them about my snow globe. But they... Gilda Balloon, my venue, the day that my brother died, I didn't cancel my show. Call the psychologist! I didn't cancel the show. And they collected enough money, like they did a little crowdfund or whatever from whoever's in the office, and they got snow globes for everyone in the audience so that...
That's amazing.
And it was a secret so that when they all walked in, I didn't know, but when I got to the part where I said... Who does anyone have a snow globe? Everyone held a snow globe in the air and I obviously bawled my fucking eyes out. But yeah, so that was really, really special. Edinburgh has a very special place in my heart.
Did that sort of ruin the show though? I mean, midway through.
Yeah, I was like, so for any general public who are just kind of here and were handed one of those.
Yeah.
I don't know how much context you've got. My brother's dead. It's all right. I kind of knew he was going to die. I'm going to move on with the show. It's just very like, well, this is what this is.
How long after your dad died did your brother die?
Yeah.
A few years. There were a few years in between. I'm not sure how many.
We know it was less than seven. Wayne was still around.
It was less than seven because Wayne was still around.
In the Wayne period.
That's the signpost. Yeah. We are deep in Wayne. We're in deep Wayne.
Which no one wants to be, really, objectively. Yeah. Knowing nothing about Wayne,
no.
Deep Wayne isn't something that I'm...
Listen, he wasn't the problem. We were the problem. And I say that in a public way. No, he was fine.
Of course. So we've got this period of time, and that's fine. But obviously, so you said your dad, it was something like 7 days, did you say, between, well, diagnosis and death, sort of horribly. What about your brother?
That was about 8 or 9 months.
Okay.
Yeah, he was put on a trial of this drug that was like, the conditions were, if you survive this, it's free. Like, if you survive for a year, it's free. And if you don't, you pay. And we paid. Isn't that...
Right. It really feels like that's the wrong way around.
Yeah.
Like, if you survive, you'd pay for it. But if they're like, if this doesn't work, you have to pay us.
Yes.
What a mental system.
That is Black Mirror shit. That's crazy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm. I don't understand the reasoning. Like, I don't know what it was for. And it was like a new experimental drug. And I think it's kind of what killed him in the end. Like, he sort of lost his mind, started hallucinating and stuff like that. Like, he really got unwell from... His system was just kind of overloaded by the medicine, which is crazy that like sometimes the dose required to keep you alive is the same as the dose that it takes to kill you.
Yeah.
And I think that's just kind of the balance that he ended up at, and that's why he died. Mm. But
he went for it though.
It was,
I mean, he went for it. Yeah. You know, he gave it the best shot, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, he fucking did. My brother tried so much. He didn't drink another drop of alcohol. Like, he immediately was just like, all right, because he had two young boys, sons and a partner. And he just went, fuck this. I'm going to fucking give everything I can.
Yeah.
And it wasn't enough. But at least he tried.
Yeah.
Because I watched my brother say about my dad that he thought that dad had sort of just given up. He was like, dad's depressed. He's given up. And I was like, what do you mean dad's depressed? He's not depressed. No one's depressed. I mean, Wayne's depressed, but nobody else is depressed. What are you talking about?
So you mentioned there that like there's this hereditary thing in your family that means you're, is it more like a lot more susceptible to specific cancers or?
Yeah. Well, I don't actually know exactly how it works because I can't get the testing because if I get the testing, I might not be able to have life insurance, things like that. Yeah, it's just a big choice to go and do the test.
Yeah.
But the thing is that it's suspected Lynch syndrome. They treat me as if I've got Lynch syndrome, which is a genetic predisposition to breast, stomach, ovarian, bowel, that kind of area, cancers. And yeah, I just don't know, but I think I might go and get the test done because it seems, A, it seems like I should just go and do it, and B, I've talked about it publicly enough that I think a life insurance company would just fucking come for me anyway.
Oh, to keep that a secret now. For your own peace of mind, would you rather know or...
I think so.
I suppose the idea is you either you might find out that you don't have it and then, poof, great. Or if you know that you do have it, then I guess it affects the way that you're going to live the rest of your life. So it's better to know than not to.
Exactly. I mean, I sort of live as if I've got it, which is what my genetic counselors think I should do, because they've said to me, like, even if you don't have it, you're still really likely to, even if you don't have this particular genetic predisposition, you're still so likely to get one of these cancers because it's just ridiculous. Like, my sister has precancerous polyps in her stomach. Like, it's just, my grandmother had pancreatic cancer. It's just really strong. So they're like, even if you test negative for this, we're still going to be treating you, but like, if you go and do this, then we know if you should have a hysterectomy, which is like a huge thing for a young woman to do. Yeah. But I don't want to have kids. So, I mean, do I want early menopause? Like, no. But do I want cancer? Also, no. So it's big. It's really big questions like that. But, I mean, God, fuck it. The perspective is such a gift. Like, even though it's awful, I am much happier now than I was when I was 17. Like, I'm happier having lost stuff because I know what it is to have things now. Does that make sense? Do you guys feel like that too?
Yeah. When you lose something or someone, you appreciate what you do have a little bit more, and you sort of, you're more aware of what you have. Sometimes, yeah. I think it can be a bit paralyzing. I think if you, like, there's that saying that you should, you know, when you should live each day like it's your last. It's like, well, that would be absolutely exhausting. That would be so much pressure if you lived every day as if it was, if like every time you said goodbye to someone, it was as if you were never going to see them again. I think that's,
I mean, I will say I kind of do live that way.
Really?
I think, yeah, I think I kind of do. Like, I'm very, you know, even if I see a stranger that like looks nice in an outfit, I'm like, excuse me, I just want to tell you, you look really great today. Because like, what if they get hit by a bus and that's the last thing they hear? I don't know. Like, I don't leave things unsaid very much.
What if they're crossing a road and you shout to them, you look great in that coat,
and I kill
and
them.
That's where they get hit.
Fuck. All right. Well, I'll have to be really careful. I don't do that.
Maybe that's the message. You should live every day like it's everyone else's last. Everyone you meet, you should treat them as if they're about to die.
So on this podcast, we like to often talk about this notion of the hierarchy of grief. People say that there isn't one. And we're going to get into that in a moment. But before we do, I want to talk about the hierarchy of friendship, because I always felt that I had the best friends. Like, Rich would probably do a lot for me.
I'm a great guy.
But Rich, if I were in a situation where I really needed you to come round, but it would require you to quit your job.
Oh, I would love to quit my job so much.
Because it strikes me that James, as previously mentioned, might actually just be the best friend of all the friends, right?
He's pretty special. He's pretty good.
Yeah, that's quite an amazing thing. And that was when your dad died. How was he when your brother died? Did he quit another job? Just feels like someone's died. Gonna quit my job again.
I think he had more leave by then. I think his job actually kept him on. Like, I think he was like, I'm leaving, and they were like, it's fine. But yeah, he was just there when my brother died. I mean, he's been there through everything. We've been friends since we were about 10.
Wow.
Which is, I think, quite rare. Sort of and it's OG really nice.
Friends, yeah.
Yeah, OG friends. It's just really nice. I find a real safety in those people. People who knew you before you were doing whatever you're doing now, you know, that's really special, and he's very special.
And how did you do with sort of talking about it after it happened? Because a lot of people, and it's quite a British thing, I think both Tom and I to an extent were like, well, that's a thing that I'll push down as far as possible and deal with that when I'm an angry old man. But obviously we're learning to talk about it, which is quite an important thing. Is that something that came naturally to you, to be able to talk to your friends about it and to sort of grieve kind of openly, or was it a learning process?
I think it's something that came naturally to me. I mean, I'm not English, and I think that helps. I mean, culturally, yeah, there's not that pressure, and I'm also a girl, so I think that helps. But yeah, my family's like Irish and Spanish, so we sing about our problems, you know.
Right.
And that's very much who I am and who I've always been. It was immediately like just straight into storytelling mode and sharing stories about the people who died, and then you know, everything's prettier when it's a poem, so just trying to make sense and make art out of it, writing songs and writing things and singing. I'm a big believer in just singing stuff out and laughing stuff out, and I think that really helped. Like, I sang at my brother's funeral and I sang at my dad's as well.
Whoa.
I spoke at both the funerals as well. Like, I was very just, I mean, I'm an actor. I've always been that. I always wanted to be that. And then I was lucky enough to do it as a job. But like, just functionally, I'm an actor. Like, I could look at it and be like, what's missing from this story? Somebody who's like stoic and strong and speaking, you know, saying small things that mean a large amount. And I was like, all right, well, I guess I'll have to do that. Like, I just sort of stepped into that role. And I think it helped me. But it meant that, like, later on, I needed to play the role of, like, girl who lost her dad and her older brother and, like, lost all the, like, older male role models that she had, like, little girl. Like, it meant that when I reached to, like, I don't know, 25, I was like, fuck, I am so sad and so alone about this because I have, like, encouraged everybody to talk about it, and I facilitated this, like, let's talk about it and let's celebrate it and let's, you know, make it so that it's, isn't it beautiful that dad was only sick for a week, because now we'll remember him as well. We don't have very many memories in the hospital, and isn't that beautiful? And, you know, my brother dying, being like, well, you know, it's great that he's gone now, because he had his, you know, he traveled for years and years before he even settled down and had a family. Like, if anyone had to go young, it's good that he did, because he had his retirement already. He's already seen the world. Like, that's, isn't that beautiful? Just finding the beauty in that stuff has always been my natural reaction to anything in the world, anything sad, anything happy. It's always like, where's the fucking poem in that? And then just my weakness is actually just letting myself be human. Like, I literally said to my psychologist 2 weeks ago, oh, it's so disgusting. And he said, what? And I said, being a person, yuck. Like, I'm just so disgusted at the fact that I have to be a human and, like, have insecurities and just, you know, sometimes worry about, like, if I'm thin enough or if I'm gonna fucking die, or just like, I'm like, oh yuck, wouldn't it be nicer if I was like a written person? Like, I just it's so yucky the like having to be a human. It's that thing of, like, you know, the horror of being truly known is the only thing that can get you to the joy of being truly loved. It's like, oh, can't I just, but if I'm a little bit famous and I go out on the stage and I do my little songs and they'll love me, they don't have to know me. Like, surely I can get around this. Like, I don't know. That's kind of my experience.
There's no shortcut. That's the annoying thing.
If I wasn't a human, I sometimes look at my rabbits and go, yeah, I could do that.
Oh, God, yeah. I remember that.
It looks lovely.
I remember that specifically from after my dad died. Every time I went home, and I was, like, the first sort of year and a half, I had, like, you know, I think we'd call a breakdown. Quite quietly. I did it in a very British quiet way where I just sort of sat inside a lot and was scared of everything. And and I used to go home to visit my mum and, like, get up in the morning and the cat would be asleep. And I was like, God, I wish I was you. I wish I could just lie there and not worry about it. And I'll get up when I want and I'll shout and someone will give me some food and I'll go back to bed. Sounds so much nicer than being a human and having to think about things.
Yeah. It's an interesting feeling.
I went home to my mum's, she lives in Scotland now as well. And I sort of visited, and my young brother and sister, they're 11 years old. And my younger sister sort of went to her room, it was sort of 11 in the morning, and the windows were shut and the lights were off. And she was just sitting on the edge of her bed, just staring into the abyss. Is that normal?
Wow.
I think your little sister is haunted.
Yeah, seems. She sounds haunted.
I think she's from a film.
She sounds like she's probably an actor, in my personal opinion. Mm. That sounds like full, like, all right, I know, I've seen this scene. I know how to do this.
Yep. Well, that's the thing you guys have got in common, is that you're both musical families. Tom's from a musical theatre family. Yes. I don't know, was your dad a big like singer and
obsessed with that kind of thing? Yeah, amateur dramatics. He was always doing stuff on stage. He was in lots and lots of shows, like, which had like good like crowds of, you know, a few hundred people, in good venues, like Bournemouth in the south of England. And he did like, generally he was like the leading man. He would have, ever since I was growing up, he would have these lead roles. I remember him being Max Bialystock in The Producers when I was sort of 16.
Oh, wow.
And he did this. Yeah, he did, it was the whole thing, you know, and it was a really good professional style production. They really did it well. And I remember coming out of that show and thinking it was like the best thing I'd ever seen. I remember coming out of that show and saying to him, like, that was the best. Like, that was your magnum opus. You'll never be better than that. That was unbelievable. And he got so annoyed that I said that.
Really? He was like, no, that you said you'd never be better.
You can never think that. You always have to be your next one best. Of course, that was ultimately his best because, you know, really dwindling returns from then on, you know.
Sucked in.
Yeah. He just, you know what I mean? He coasted. No, all the way up until the end, he was due to be in Starlight Express before he'd learned how to roller skate and everything.
And then
diagnosis the week of. And he said, I just don't feel up to this, guys. And I do sometimes really feel this tinge of regret about that because I feel like I might have been able to convince him to do it.
Yeah.
But if he didn't want to do it.
One last ride.
Nobody wants to see a man weeping on rollerblades. That's the risk.
That is true.
He's skating around the stage in tears.
Tears.
That
pouring.
Is the risk, and I say that all the time. Yeah.
And that's also a safety risk, of course, because the tears are clearly a slip hazard.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
Oh, that's devastating.
But
I wish he'd done it.
Me too. Well, he didn't want anything to be the last time he did something. I was wondering if you'd had experience similar to this with your brother, where my dad wanted nothing to be the last time. So there was no goodbye or anything like that. There was no. We still did things. Obviously, he didn't stay inside. But we went to the zoo together, and it wasn't like this is the last time we're going. It was like, it's a normal thing we're doing, guys.
Yeah. I mean, I think my brother sort of knew. We'd watched my dad die so recently, and my brother just was like, all right, this is it. Like, when I went to Edinburgh, I was going to cancel the show and not go. And he was like, no, you have to go. Like, you have to go because you will keep living and your life is important. I will not keep living. You can't stay here for me. I'll be dust soon. Like, he was just very, very...
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, but I mean, he was kind of... It was kind of magical the way he was so honest and, like, he loved traveling and he was like, I want you to go. Like, I want you to go and do these things and see these things. And he was like, well, fuck, like, we've got to go and I can't go, so you have to go. There was a sense of the last time. I mean, there was a sense of goodbye when I left to go to Edinburgh. We went to his house, which is in a different city, and I went to see him, and it was very much like, this is, we're coming in case you die, which he knew. Mm. And I think that was kind of all right. The last Christmas was like, this is the last Christmas.
Yeah.
Which was just, you know... I don't know why, but he always seemed so wise and I always trusted him. And maybe because he knew that, maybe he knew that I trusted him and that I would feel safe if he said it's fine, that he just made it feel fine.
We spoke a bit earlier about, you talk about this kind of finding the beauty and the poetry in death, and you sort of referring to your parents. And I was sort of thinking about that, about my dad, and trying to think of what that was. And I suppose my version of that for my dad would be that he loved a bargain. Like this, he loved it.
Really?
Like,
so did my dad.
Oh yeah, here we go. Now we've got some common ground. That
yes.
The art of the deal was this man's life. Like any kind of like deal, bargain, getting something for nothing, he was obsessed with. To the extent, and he lived and died by that. To the extent that he literally only got his prostate examined because he was able to get it for free.
Oh my god!
Like, and you can do that. By the way, we have universal healthcare here. He could have done that anyway on the NHS, but no. This was a private. This was like Bupa. He could get like private prostate exam. Yes, please. I'll have one of those.
Oh my god!
That's the kind of man this man was. Not that I imagine that. I don't really imagine that. Whichever way you cut it, there's two fingers going up your bum, right? I can't imagine that private versus public prostate exams are
two
different.
I think private, you get to choose the fingers, and that's kind of it.
There's like a water feature, you know? It's like gentle, calming sounds, but ultimately feels the same. But he was bragging about it. He was saying, yeah, no, actually, I got that on my partner's healthcare at work, actually, so I didn't have to pay for it. So
that's
whatever.
So funny.
And like, he's... spoke that up for a while until obviously he ultimately said, you know, he's like, oh, they're setting me for another one. Yeah? Like,
oh, God. Okay.
By the third one, we were all a bit like, well, now, hang on a second. Either this is a man who likes prostate exams too much or in trouble. And of course, subsequently, we were in deep trouble.
Were they all free?
All free. All free.
Nice. So he'll have been happy about that.
He would have loved that fact. So there is a sort of beauty in that, in that the way he found out, it was, if he had a way he could choose how to find out he had cancer, I'm sure that was the way.
In the private system,
in the private
for free.
System for free. It's his way of doing it. But you know, at the end, he had, now I really think about it, at the end, he had a hospital bed in his living room. So he was able to die at home, which is a lovely kind of palliative care they did.
Oh, that's amazing.
Beautiful. The nurse from Macmillan sort of made it all work and that kind of thing. But he didn't have to pay for that hospital bed. So I think, I'm sure somewhere in there he must have been thinking, ho, 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 got this one. Hey, dying.
That's great.
But, whoa, got one over. So there is a kind of beauty in that.
Dying for free.
Dying for free. So Rich, is there a kind of... beauty or poetry in meningitis, other than the, I guess, the link between illness and your dad being a doctor.
Yeah, I mean that's not a positive bit of poetry, that he was ill with something to the point where he was going to die and he didn't realise. But I guess
irony, I guess, yeah.
It's a bit dark, but one thing that we said at the time was, so Michelle, my dad had meningitis, but it sort of presented very suddenly, so he was fine, then he was a little bit ill in the morning, and then he just died, and that was it. So
how do you get meningitis?
Well, he was a GP, so I think we reckon he caught it off someone who came in to see him, but it can live in your body for quite a long time, and then just sort of suddenly, like, lots of people carry it but don't have any symptoms and it never affects them and stuff.
That's incredibly noble.
So that's how he died. Oh. But the kind of dark poetry in it is that, so he died, and my brother and my mum were there and had to try and resuscitate him, but he'd gone into cardiac arrest, so he was gone, and they knew that he was gone, but as a GP, he used to watch, my mum used to watch Holby City, which is a British soap set in a hospital, and she loved it. He hated it because they always got it wrong. And so he would be very angry. And he'd be very angry in any film or TV series where someone had a cardiac arrest and then got resuscitated. Because he was always like, you don't come back from a cardiac arrest. That doesn't happen. You don't come back and you're fine because someone's given you mouth to mouth or whatever. And so we were like, I mean, the poetry of it is that if they had successfully given him resuscitation, he would have
they would have proved him wrong.
He'd have woken up. So pissed off that his lifelong catchphrase of, you don't come back from cardiac arrest, have been proven wrong. So if anything, it was a happy ending. that he went the way that he did.
At least he went out nobly.
Exactly. And I like to think, like Tom's dad with saving money, that there was a moment where he was like, yeah, good luck with this one. See you later. And he was off.
So how long did he didn't suffer for very long then at all?
No, he felt ill the night before, went to bed, woke up with a bit of a fever that morning, so took the morning off work, was planning to go in the afternoon, and then just fell into like a really deep sleep, woke up around midday, shouted for help, and was dead within 3 minutes, probably. So it was very, very quick.
And are you grateful for that?
Yeah. I mean, we've talked about it a lot because Tom and I had sort of opposite experiences, and there's upsides and there's downsides. There was no watching him deteriorate. By the time I found out he was dead, he'd been dead for 6 hours. But there was also, there was no goodbye. There was no sort of time. And Tom had, your dad was ill for 2 years.
2 years. But Rich, I've just realised
Tom,
something.
I'm sure you had lots of goodbyes.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, he bluntly refused to have one. I've just realised that me and Rich have had this debate repeatedly. Which is worse? Rich's dad dying quickly, my dad dying over a period of 2 years and watching him suffer. But Michelle,
ooh,
you've experienced both.
Oh yeah.
Yes.
Holy hell. I mean, you actually might be able to, I mean, really, either settle it if it's in my favour or provide evidence to the contrary if it's in Rich's.
Listen, I mean, it's different. My brother was younger and had more to live for. My dad was like, he was retired. Mm. He, you know, oof. I think I am glad that my brother had more time and my dad had less time. If it had been the reverse, I think it would have been very cruel.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what makes me think maybe it is better to have less time. But then, I mean, I don't know. I've got two young nephews and one of my youngest nephew, he is so afraid that his mum will die. He is so afraid. And he, like, she went into hospital because she is an incredible woman. She's a nurse, mm-hmm, and she is from Canada. She lives in Australia now. Her last partner before my brother, he died in a plane accident. And now she's got these two kids. They're great, great boys. Both of them neurodivergent. She is autistic herself. They've got, you know, so they have there's a lot of high psychologist bills between them, but you know, we're not American, so it's okay. You know, it's not the end of the world financially. But you know, that it's a lot to carry, and she's a nurse, and she most recently just got, God, I've just forgotten what it is, but it's like, you're like gardening, and then you breathe stuff in and you get, Legionnaire's disease. She had Legionnaire's disease.
Oh shit, that is awful.
Which was just because she had been gardening without like a mask on, which everybody does. And yeah, she got Legionnaire's disease and she went to hospital and she was really sick and we didn't know what it was. And my nephew was just not well, like really sick about it, really scared because he's seen someone go to hospital and not come back. And I think as somebody really young, that's really hard to watch. I don't know. I remember after my dad died, I was really grateful that it was quick.
Mm.
I think for a parent, quick is better. And I wish a quick death on my mum. I love my mum so much and I don't want her to have a whole drawn out thing. I want to remember her, you know, going to golf and gossiping about the neighbours. I don't want to remember her in a hospital, not able to go to the bathroom herself. And as someone who spent a lot of time in hospital, unable to walk, unable to move, unable to bend my knees, even when I was young, like, that's awful. It's fucking awful and it's humiliating. And I remember just lying there and being like, who's going to want me now? Like, I'm so fucking useless. What would possibly go well for me? Like the lack of hope is astonishing and the lack of autonomy. And so I think quicker is better, but I think if it was me, fuck, I'd want as much time as I could have. I know that's a really rambling answer, but my brother lost his mind quite slowly and my dad didn't. So, you know, I didn't get to see the worst of my dad. And I don't really remember him in the hospital. I remember him out, whereas I remember my brother sick.
What you're saying is really, really, really interesting, because I had only thought about this before from the perspective of physical illness, seeing my dad looking unwell. But, you know, actually, it's so correct. I mean, the cancer spread to his brain, like, and they had to take out parts of his brain.
Mm.
Like, you know, that's going to affect the way your brain functions. And it wasn't always clear, but certainly, and maybe it was also just the fact that he wasn't able to work anymore. And so he's watching a lot of YouTube videos, and the algorithm, especially when your mail really starts going, have you tried Jordan B. Peterson?
No. What if you just ate meat? What if you just ate meat for a month? What do you think about that?
If it was meat or pasta?
Eat meat. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just do that.
I mean, you watch one of those videos, and then your front page is just all of those videos. Not that he did, but I don't know, but certainly by the end, when conversations took a slight political turn, because of my job, they sometimes would, he would occasionally just pop up with an opinion, which really was quite sad to hear, because he was always a very smart man, I always felt. And I feel like a lot of what I've got in terms of critical thinking comes from him and the way he taught me when I was younger. But by the end, you know, he didn't say anything along the lines of there are lizard people in government. But
right, yes,
the concept was on the table. And I think that was where we were starting to get to, was real conspiracy theories were starting to sneak in. That level of jet fuel can't melt steel beams as a starting point.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which was clearly starting to open some doors, which I can't get into because of my job. And I think that was really sad to see. That was really sad to see, because it does affect your memory of somebody when suddenly you want to spend time, you want to be around them as much as you can, because there's not much time left. But the more time you're spending with them, you're not necessarily spending with the person you want to spend the time with.
Yeah, yeah, it's really hard.
Yeah, I said something philosophical there. How about that? Come on, Rich.
Is it? I was just wondering, because obviously I didn't have this experience, but it's something that worries me. You were saying about your mum, you hope that she would go quickly. I have the same thought about my mum. I feel like people whose parents develop Alzheimer's or dementia, and the idea that my mum wouldn't be able to remember me is very, very sort of painful to think about. And I wonder with your brother and with your dad, you hear people say like, oh, well, that, you know, he wasn't himself by the end. Can you separate those two things? Can you sort of, you have those memories of him, but are you able to go, that's not who he really was? Or is that actually, that is a part of him, just a horrible part at the end?
For me, it's I was overseas when my brother lost himself, and it all went downhill really quickly. Like, he went home and started packing for a trip overseas, and his partner, because she's a nurse, she's so smart, she was like, yep, and she helped him pack, and then she took him to the airport, and the airport was the hospital, and that was it. Like, it all happened really quick. My mum saw it, my sister-in-law saw it, and my nephew saw it, but I didn't see it. So I was very lucky. And with my dad, you know, he held on to things for quite a long time. My nan, she had Alzheimer's, and it was really hard on my mum. Like, I never knew my nan without Alzheimer's, and I really watched it chip away at my mum. How do you feel about it? I mean, you saw your dad really lose it. What's your response to this question?
I didn't like it. It's awful. it really sucked, to be honest. You know, because there's a thing about dads, which I think, I don't know why it's more of a thing I have with my dad than my mum, but I was always very, very, very eager to tell him when I did something good. You know?
Yeah.
And my career is sort of the thing I've done the best, and getting this job in a prestigious newsroom and working really hard at it and writing stuff and appearing on radio and all these kinds of bits and bobs. When I would do that, I would desperately quickly tell him, look at this. And he would be like, come on, man, you're nailing it. And that was so good. By the end, when I would mention a thing I'd done at work, that would sort of be a trigger for him to get into the topic of politics, was often not good, unfortunately.
And oh my gosh, that must have been awful.
It was sad. It was really sad. I mean, it kind of touches on a much broader sad note, which is that once your dad dies, or at least in my case, once my dad died, I constantly wanted to tell him, or actually, he used to text me and say, I've read this. And that was great.
Oh,
and it's
yeah.
so sad that he doesn't anymore. That's so sad, man.
Yeah.
Mm. Rich?
That's one of the things that you do. You get used to your dad or your brother or someone not being around. But you don't ever really get used to that thing of not being able to tell them stuff. I find it quite hard that my dad has never met my girlfriend. And that's a thing where you're like, oh, you would have really got on. You would have really liked her and she would have really liked him. And it's sort of a thing that when I think about it, it's like, oh yeah, that pain's still there. And it's good to know. It's good
yeah.
to have a little shot of it every yeah. now and again and go, oh yeah, okay, that's it. I still feel it.
My brother was my biggest supporter and I would, you know, write songs and he would call me in the middle of the night with his friends at a party and he'd be drunk and he'd be playing the song for the party. Like he'd taken over the music.
Oh, wow.
And he was so proud of me. And a lot of my friends and colleagues now are the people that were his favorite comedians and TV stars when he was growing up. Mm. And I wish I could tell him because he feels like he's the person in my family who would understand. Like my mum, I'm on like every TV channel in Australia and she can put on any TV channel and I will at some stage of the night probably pop up and she'll be like, but she doesn't get like, I'll say, did you see this thing? And she'll say, yes, yes, that was good. Did you get paid for that? I'm like, yes, mum, it's my job. Like, what do you think? I don't work in a shop anymore. It's been a while. Like, why don't you think, like, people stop you in the street. Of course, I got paid for that. But, like, things like that, she just doesn't relate to that. Was my brother had so much context for it and so much understanding. He was the only person in my family who I could turn to and be like, you know, I just worked with this person or I just, you know, like I, it's just a weird, a really weird little thing. Like, oh, I just got a compliment from a member of Monty Python backstage. Mm. And like, you understand that because you're the reason I watch Monty Python, like things like that.
Yeah.
That are just like, that's the biggest absence is that sort of, you know, father figure or you know, older person figure that can, because my brother was like 15 years older than me. Like he was a proper adult by the time I was even sentient. But he built me so much and I loved him so much. I admired him so much that I became exactly who it's like I'm his kid. Like he was like, these are the things that are cool. And I was like, great, I love those things. And I just became all the things that he loved. And then I started doing them for a job. But by the time they were my job, he was gone. Mm. But it's also like part of the reason that I do them as a job is because I went to Edinburgh that year and because I just kept going. And it's part of the reason that I just keep going and I'm not afraid to put my hand up and be like, let me have a go. I'm good. I promise. And if I'm not good, I'll fix it. Like I'll figure it out. Like just let me figure it out because I don't know how much time I have. And because I'm like, I feel like I'm collecting experiences for someone. And I feel sometimes like they're for him. Like it's like when you're amassing things and you like to pass on as a legacy to a child, but this is not, I'm not going to have children. It's not for a child. It's for my brother. And I'm not religious, like I don't think he's watching. It's just, it's kind of just for, to point to and go, thank you. And I'm doing this because you showed me, you opened this door and now I own the house of this door. Like it's that.
Yeah.
And I really am sad about that.
Well, you said legacy there and it does almost feel like that's what, this is all your career in it to an extent is his legacy because you're doing it because it was what he showed you sort of the way of.
Yeah, and he could have done it too. He was funny and he was a great singer.
How do you find the experience of talking about your dad and your brother on stage? Because you've done a Average Bear, the show is sort of quite prominently about that experience.
Yeah.
Did it take quite a long time before you were able to do that, or was it something that was part of the grieving process?
Yeah, it took a while. My brother died in 2015 and I did average bear in 2021 because of COVID. So I wrote it in like 2019. And I had been, you know, writing bits and pieces. I'd been telling the story at like storytelling nights for like little 10 minute versions of it. And I just noticed how much it resonated with other people. What I really noticed was like how much it helped other people who were grieving. And I really liked that. That it could be something positive and not, because, you know, I'm sick of, there's so many people willing to like stand on stage and cry. And I was like, well, I'm not going to stand on stage and cry. Like, I'm not doing that. I don't want people to pay me so they can watch me cry and I can complain to them about my life. I'm not doing that. There's enough people out there doing it. I'm not doing that. I was a big believer in like, I need to be finished processing all of this before I tell the story. I need to have a handle on this so that it is a story and not something that just is like sitting in my chest ready to hook on to any rib that I make available. Like I need to be able to get through this in front of my family, in front of people who are dying, actively fucking dying. And I have, like, this needs to be ready for anyone in any circumstance before I can do it. And so that's why it took me a while, but I love it. I mean, it's such a wonderful way to share grief through laughter and music. Like, for goodness sake, if there's anything about being human that's nice, it's that. Like, it's so special. Average Bear is great because I directly deal with them, but I think every time I'm on stage, they're always just kind of there. Like, I think you can tell from watching a performer. Like, sometimes I'll watch a play or something and I'll walk out and I'll go, they've never lost a fucking thing in their life. And it's just like you see this performance, it's like, oh, this is a lovely, like, caricature of loss or love or whatever you think this is, and you're doing your best, and it doesn't mean you're not a good actor, it just means you've never lost anything, and good for you, well done you, hold on to that, I hope you never lose anything. But when you watch somebody who has lost something, there's no, like, you're not worried about trying to appeal to a certain kind of person, you just don't care as much about what people think, and so you're able to be kinder and more interested in people, because you're not going, I'm this kind of person, just so you know, I'm this and I'm that. And it's not, you know, a left and right and right and wrong. It's just like, it's asking questions rather than trying to come and pretend you've got answers. It's there's something that comes from grief that, I don't know. So I've started a speech. I didn't mean to do this.
But no, you're right. It's humbling in a way, isn't it? You realize that you don't have all the answers and you don't know everything. And
yes, and that's and nice. That's
the thing when you see, because we all will have them. We've seen people either act or write or produce something that's about grief, and as soon as you watch it, you're like, you don't know what you're talking about. You think you do. You're imagining what this might be like, but you have no idea.
Yes, and good for you. And it's lucky, great.
Oh yeah, that's. That's fantastic. Well done. But maybe don't tread on our toes at this moment.
Yes, stay in your own fucking lane. It's small moments. Grief is not about the death. Grief is about, like, oh, fuck, what do we do with these ties? Like, that's what grief is.
Oh, let me tell you something. It is all about that. I think probably it's a good idea if we start to wrap things up a little bit, because we've had about 2 hours of your evening.
Yeah, really? Sorry. Oh my god.
I'm very mindful that it's approaching 11 p.m. now in Melbourne, and or Melbourne, or however you pronounce it.
Melbourne.
But thank you very much for coming on. So when's your Edinburgh show run? And you know, we could probably put a little, you know, like what's the how do you plug it?
Oh yeah. Yeah, do a little plug.
Do a little plug, is it? Or
come along, everyone's dead. It starts on whenever the festival starts, and it ends whenever the festival ends.
Brilliant.
It goes for the entire time, except for I think the 16th. But the internet will hold the answers to that. It's at the Gilded Balloon at 7 or 7:30, and it's a show that I wrote. It's got a live band in it, and it's about the man that scammed me. True story. Man that scammed me online, and how I became his friend. And eventually his emergency contact at the hospital. My partner, Tim, plays the scammer, which is he hates doing, but it's very very fun. So it's really it's a wild ride. It's very fun.
Brilliant. So if you're listening, you know what's in it, though you're not sure exactly when or at what time. But other than that, yeah. Roughly, I mean, listen, August.
I think it's at 7:30 in August.
We'll check
in the Gilded Balloon at Teviot, which is in Bristow Square, which is near the Meadows, which is near Marchmont.
Look, just if you can get to the Gilded Balloon for, let's say, 6:30, just to be safe.
Yeah.
And then you'll give yourself half an hour at least to find it. You'll be fine.
Yeah, that kind of thing.
Yeah, it'll be good fun.
Well, fortunately for Michelle, we do know what time it is and where it is. It's the Gilded Balloon Teviot.
Teviot.
Say that? Gilded Balloon Teviot, August 2nd to the 15th, as well as 17th to the 27th. So basically throughout the whole month at 7 p.m. And it's an hour long, as basically every show at Edinburgh is. Go along, have a good time. We're both going to go, aren't we, Rich?
We're going to go, yeah. We're going to try and meet up and go at the same time.
Yeah, that's the plan. Fun. We'll see. I'll be there for your show too, of course.
Oh yeah, good. We should mention, if you are in Edinburgh and you're going to go and see Michelle, why not on a different day, because the times do clash? Why not come and see Little Richie's Fords? I'm doing my show Look Who Loves Me at Hootenanny's at the Apex at 6:10 from the 6th until the 19th. It's a work in progress, but it'll be quite good the later in the run that you come.
Yeah,
First few days might be dicey.
I understand you've written a lot of it.
I've written more than all of it.
More than all of it. So it's now
it's only 45 situation. Minutes, and I've got significantly more than that.
Okay.
So yeah, it's just working out which are the best bits and then making them better.
So there you go. You can go and see Rich, and if it does feel like it's dragging on a bit, it is only 45. So it's,
yeah, believe it or not, it's actually a short show.
He won't keep you the whole hour, and you're charging how much ticket?
It's free. Or you can guarantee yourself a ticket with, you can pay £5 in advance and then you've definitely got a seat. You can turn up on the door and hope it's free. But then at the end, I will ask you for money. So it would save us all a lot of indignity if you just paid in advance.
Yeah, you don't want to be in a situation where you get there and it's sold out. Well, Rich does, but you,
I'd love that,
don't.
Yeah.
You don't want to be in that situation.
You also don't want to be in a situation where you show up, it isn't sold out, you sit through the show, it's not very good, but at the end I stand and you have to walk past me and say, do you know what, mate? I don't think that's worth paying for. Nobody wants that to happen.
That'd be uncomfortable, wouldn't it? And,
yeah.
You know, so, and you're recommending £5 is really reasonable.
Yeah, I think £5 is fair.
So if you go, bring your fivers.
Yeah.
Yeah, brilliant. All right, great.
I'm not going to turn away a tenner. Don't get me wrong.
No. But you would turn around. You would turn away £4.90.
I'd knock it out of your hands. Yeah, absolutely.
You'd say, what the fuck is this?
Yeah.
Get that the hell out of here.
I'd knock it out of your hands. Leave, then when, as you were picking it up, I'd say, now put it in the bucket. And then you put it in the bucket. I'd say, but technically to me, that is nothing.
Yeah, you owe me 10 pence as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
Rightly so. Well, I agree with you. And on one of those days, I'll be there to help smack away the cash of foolhardy individuals.
Are you bringing a fiver? Sure.
Well, I'm going to be buying my seat ahead of time. I don't want to be missing out. You know, I don't want to be one of the fools who might risk missing the show.
I'll buy you a pint to say thanks for that. But that offer is for Tom only. I can't stress enough. I can't afford to buy everyone a pint because it's probably more than £5 for a pint. So I will be losing even more money than I've already lost on this massive vanity project.
Just out of curiosity, if everybody did give you a fiver, how many people would have to come each night for you to break even?
Well, on just the venue cost? Actually, not that many. 50 over the whole run. That would pay the venue.
And the whole shebang?
Oh, the whole shebang. Well, I mean, we're talking sold out every night.
And
then I don't know.
I was going to say, if you cost. Sold out every night, you wouldn't actually.
And if we're talking the amount of money that I've invested into comedy over the 6 years that I've been doing it, then, I mean, I don't think that's never coming back. I'd need a salaried role.
You've had to take leave as well, presumably.
This will be the most stressful holiday I've ever had.
In lieu of that, so it's
so yeah.
Well, anyway, much as you should do what I do and get yourself a ticket ahead of time so you don't miss out on Rich's, you should do the same thing so you don't miss out on Michelle Gracious show, absolutely. Reform, which I've already got my tickets. I'm very excited. I saw her other, I mentioned in the podcast, I saw her other show in London, which was very funny, kind of musical singing thing. And this is a similar musical singing thing.
That's how she builds it as well, isn't
it? She builds it like that. It's a good time.
Do this kind of musical singing thing.
Yes, I don't know if it'll have quite as much grief as the last one did, but maybe it will. Maybe it'll have just as much grief as this episode did, which had an extraordinary amount of grief.
Yeah, and that's one of the good things. If you've listened to this episode and you do love grief, you can still go and see Michelle, and even if she doesn't directly reference the grief, you know it's there. You know it's behind everything. You know she's gone through pain, and sometimes that improves her performance. Right, I think we've probably taken up enough of your time. That was quite a long episode, but we had so much that we wanted to talk to Michelle about that it was very hard to cut it down. We had hours, but it was a long episode. You've got stuff to do. You've got a life to live. We can't stop you from living it, because who knows? You could die tomorrow. You could die tomorrow. As we always say, death comes to us all.
But it comes to you first. See you next week.
We'll see you in a bit. Bye-bye.